Hello and welcome to Mixture of Experts. I'm your host, Tim Huang. Each week, Mixture of Experts brings together a brilliant team of researchers, product experts, engineers, and more working at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence. We debate, distill, and discuss down the biggest news of the week in AI, from product announcements and the hottest papers on archive to industry gossip and NVIDIA stock price. This week, three stories. First up, Scarlett Johansson versus OpenAI, the Sky voice controversy. Who's right, who's wrong, and what does it tell us about where things are going in the design of AI products? Second, who's afraid of the FMTI? The Center for Research on Foundation Models at Stanford University have released the latest edition of their Foundation Model Transparency Index, or FMTI. What is it, and why does it matter? And then finally, last but not least, it's announcement season, and announcement season continues with IBM Think hot on the heels of OpenAI and Google. WatsonX is seeing a bunch of major announcements. What to tell us about the future of AI and enterprise, and more specifically, about the future of open source in enterprise. So the panelists, as always, I'm joined by an S-tier set of panelists for us today. First off, Marina Danilevsky, a senior research scientist. Welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
Kate Sewell, Program Director, Generative AI Research. Thanks and welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Tim.
And finally, Armand Ruiz, Vice President, Product Management on the AI platform.
Thank you so much. Hi, everybody.
I want to tackle our kind of first story, which was sort of the hot news of the week, the ScarJo versus OpenAI controversy. So hot on the heels of GPT-4o announcements the other week, and basically Sam Altman simply tweeting her, there had already been a lot of major speculation that essentially the Spike Jones film from about a decade ago, Her, was somehow weirdly ending up being the template for OpenAI's product development. And all of this kind of took a major turn when Scarlett Johansson herself released a public statement saying that OpenAI had approached her to use her voice. And then when she had refused, had proceeded to release a similar one, a kind of stunningly similar one. In fact, so similar that people had been like, that sounds like Scarlett Johansson, when OpenAI was demoing GPT-4o the other week. And so I think the main question, you know, I think we can get into the who's right, who's wrong here. But I think the kind of first question that I wanted the kind of panel to opine on is, you know, the unbelievable thing for me is like Her is like a movie that's like a decade old, and that like Scarlett Johansson is still like the cultural template for like the kind of assistive technologies that people are working on today, to the point that like one of the leading companies in the space almost explicitly is like really still using that movie as kind of like a template for their product development. And I guess I'm kind of curious if any of you have kind of thoughts about like the persistence of like the vision in Her and why it still is so kind of compelling today, or if actually, you know, you think it's actually kind of silly that people think that it is so compelling. I don't know if any you have any thoughts. I mean, Kate, Armand, you're new to the show, but I don't know if you would want to jump in first with some thoughts on that.
I can start. I mean, look, from my perspective, and most of my conversations are always with within an enterprise setup, but everything related to voice imitation, and which is a technology that has been progressing a lot in the last few years, is a big concern, and I think that's why we're seeing this acceleration on regulations, because these examples are just freaking people out, honestly, right? And we need to be careful, especially when companies like OpenAI, that they have so much reach and hype around them. And by the way, that demo was spectacular in every single sense. And it's a little bit sad that all we're talking about is this controversy on the resemblance on the voice with Scarlett Johansson. I think there was this opportunity to just pick another voice or make it less closer to her, given like that they tried actually to get her voice officially in the system, and that didn't work out. I don't know, Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the draw to having a Scarlett Johansson type voice is really, you know, an attempt to try and get trust and comfort with these systems. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where I think a lot of the initial ambitions lay. But if you think about it, like these models are tools. They're not people, they're not humans, they're tools. And is this really the right tone? And even I mean, there are huge issues on data rights to consider, but even that aside, is this the right tone and mode in which to actually communicate the value and that these tools can offer?
Yeah, for sure. I think that's kind of one of the funny things. I mean, to first respond to Armand, I think like, you know, everybody I know who is like more in the machine learning space saw the demo and they're like, low latency, it's crazy, right? And then everybody else who kind of saw the demo who are less in the AI space were like, it's her. And it's sort of interesting like what people pick up from demos depending on their level of familiarity with the technology. But I guess, Kate, would love to kind of go into the point that you just made a little bit more. You know, I think there's a kind of question of like, should we be imitating her in the first place? Like, I think her is kind of such a fascinating movie because I watched it again recently because I've been talking to a bunch of people being like, oh yeah, it's like a great product vision, like her. And then you watch her and like the whole point of her is like, this is a bad direction for technology to be going down. And so it's like very strange to me that like, you know, it's become a template in some ways. And I guess to kind of pick up what is sort of what you're saying that like we actually might not want technology companies to really kind of imitate like a human companion, like that there's some ethical concerns that you have around that, or maybe your point is actually maybe in a different direction.
Well, you know, there's a principle in data storytelling and data visualizations that, you know, the what you visualize should reflect the data and how it was created. And so if you're uncertain and there's uncertainty, you should visualize error bars, for example. You know, and I think a similar principle applies for large language models, like the mechanism and the mode of how you communicate the results that the model is saying and the tone and intonation, everything that you're doing is providing a lot of information for the user, whether you realize it or not. And I don't think that human voices should be off the table, but, you know, very flirtatious female human voices for something that's meant to be a tool and an assistant, you know, is that really the right mode and mechanism? And I think there's a right way and a wrong way. And it's, you know, it's sometimes hard to define exactly what correct and wrong is, but, you know, this one seems to lean a little bit too far to the, to the wrong side.
Definitely. And it's sort of interesting because I think like when you get to the realm of voice, you really are working on like people's kind of cultural priors, right? Like you could imagine a voice which was like very like sci-fi robotic. It's like very arbitrary what voice we wanted to produce. And like, you know, I guess in that sense, maybe it communicates more that it is a computer that you're talking with versus a person.
Well, and there's like ways to earn trust, right, in systems and to make people feel more comfortable. But like, you know, there's also real reasons to have some skepticism of what you're hearing from models. And there's, you know, proper ways to go about showing that models are not confident and that there are risks and things that should be evaluated objectively by humans. And if we're just being told something in a very trusting, loving voice, then, you know, are we really doing our due diligence here as model providers and giving our customers the right, you know, putting them in the right mindset of how to use these models in a responsible way?
Totally. So Marina, I want to bring you in. I know you're a veteran to the show, but I think one of the reasons I was very excited to have you back on was last time you were talking about Inspector Raggett, right? And I think the conversation that we had at that point was, well, how do we know that RAG is doing well? We need to build kind of like a dashboard experience for people to kind of monitor and understand whether or not they should trust the results coming out of a RAG process. And I guess as someone who has like worked so deeply with that as a method, right, like the dashboard as the way you establish trust versus like the voice as the interface, how do you feel about voice? Are you like kind of suspicious about it? Like I'm getting suspicious vibes from Kate, but I'm kind of curious about like how you kind of navigate this as we think about like all the different interfaces we can have in sort of assessing like model trust, essentially, which really seems like we're talking about.
Sure. I will say, I don't think that the dashboard is the only way. And it tends to be the kind of thing that is, again, more understandable to model developers. Normal folks don't understand it. And actually, often, I think it's a way to have even less trust. Because if you have somebody who's not technical, they're going to look at it and be like, what am I supposed to do with all these numbers, all of this, all of that? Like, tell me sort of at the end of the day. So I really, really agree with what Kate is saying, which is that it's important in how you deliver the information at the end, finally, to the end user. You should give in terms that are obvious to the person receiving it, whether you should trust and how you should take it. So like one direction that's a little bit worrying is the amount of people using these language models, for example, as ad hoc psychologists or ad hoc friends or girlfriends or anything of that kind. Yeah. So now we're going to make sure that now we have that in Scarlett Johansson's voice. That seems, again, not maybe the right direction to go.
Let's just pour some gasoline on this.
Right. And certainly not in the enterprise setting. So voice is great, but it should also be a way to communicate, just as in text, or, you know, to what extent should I be really trusting what you say, and can you give me the appropriate caveats? There's a responsibility here. Just as when you read something that reads extremely fluent, you hear something and it's extremely fluent, it's got that affect and it sounds human, of course you're going to have a tendency to take it in a particular way. I think there's a lot of responsibility on the people providing these models to do that accordingly.
Yeah, I never really... So, oh, yeah, Armin, go ahead. Yeah,
I just want to add two quick things. One, I think maybe it's a little bit controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Please do.
Here we are talking about it, right? So I think Sam Altman is like Elon Musk. They know very well, they are very smart how to market their products. And they had the Google conference right after this their event. And they always find ways to be on the headlines, one way or the other. So I think they like a little bit of controversy. I think maybe this one is getting a little bit out of control, but it's not the first one that they faced. And on the other hand, I think there is also about voice. I think voice has been the promise for AI for many years with Siri, with Alexa, but it was low latency, it was very robotic. So that demo and the Google demo, and there was a similar demo a few years ago, very researchy from Google, that was showing already like a more natural voice. And at some point, it's going to always be a problem. Any voice they put is going to resemble to someone else's voice. So this is a very difficult conversation in this case, is because we're talking about a celebrity, and voice cloning from celebrities is going to be a problem. But we will always have these problems that these voices will resemble someone else.
Actually, I wanted to respond to something that you said. I don't like Elon Musk and Sam Altman speaking for all of us that are working in AI. They like controversy. They're very, you know, tech bro kind of guys. Okay, great. But this assumption that, you know, all publicity is good publicity, and as long as you're talking about me, that's great. It's not reflective, I think, a lot of us that are here. And also the idea of, well, why wouldn't Scarlett Johansson agree to be the voice? She should be honored that she was asked. She was in a sci-fi movie about this. So clearly this is the same thing. That level of assumption and that level of, well, it should be an honor to participate in anything that I do, that leaves a very bad taste in a lot of our mouths. And I just want to say a lot of us are not pleased and do not. That doesn't represent us.
So we'll move on, actually, because we have three topics to get to. So I'm going to bring up the second topic, and Kate, I'll bring you in to kind of lead us on this, but just to kind of quickly tee us up. So this is a big week. There's a group called the Center for Research on Foundation Models at Stanford University. Percy Lang and a number of his collaborators there have been working for some time on something they call the Foundation Model Transparency Index, or FMTI for short. And it effectively is kind of this annual index they're doing of leading foundation models evaluating effectively their commitment to transparency. And I guess, Kay, I figured, you know, just for our listeners, it's worth it kind of talk a little bit about what it is in the first place. And then I know you were actually working in a pretty deep way on this just recently. So we'd love to kind of hear about sort of your involvement and sort of IBM's involvement in the FMTI.
Yeah, absolutely. So Stanford's report in the Transparency Index is a compilation of 100 different questions that they basically ask model providers to understand how transparent and open they are across the model lifecycle. So they look at everything from upstream, how is the data curated, what rights do you have to the data, are you transparent about what data you use, to the model itself is the second main category. So have you evaluated your model for different risks? Do you describe those risks? Do you provide mitigations for those risks? And then also to the downstream uses, like are you clear with your usage and policies? Do you talk about how you would enforce those usage policies? Where are your models being used and those types of applications? So what it does really well and what I really appreciate about it is it's not trying to evaluate and say, this is an unbiased model or this score, if you score well, that means your models are safe. What it's doing is trying to look at how open are model providers about their own technology? Are people actually sharing what they've built, sharing the degree to which they've tested different safety aspects, and are sharing those with their own customers or not? And, you know, that's something that I'm really, really passionate about in the entire team here for IBM that trains Granite models have strongly felt we need to show up very strongly on. So our Granite models were ranked in this report. We're really excited. We came in fourth overall. And especially on the upstream, like all of the data collection and all the work that we do on the curation and transparency around what data goes into our models, we were one of the top scoring model providers. So the Granite models showed up very well in that report. And we're really excited by those results.
Yeah, congratulations. I know it's like very competitive, actually. Like the number of kind of like companies and sort of models that they're covering was like very vast.
I mean, they covered the top 14 or so model providers. This is the second time they did the report. The first time was back in October, and they looked at the top 8 or so. And it's a really, really exciting area.
Yeah, for sure. So I think there's a bunch of interesting questions I want to kind of talk to the panel about. Really kind of about sort of like governance in the universe of AI. Because I think there's sort of two very interesting things going on that I see in FMTI, right? Like I think one of them is, you know, even a few years ago, and it still kind of is this way, right? Like I think like a lot of the process of, you know, pre-training, fine-tuning models is like shrouded in mystery, where people are like, oh, well, you know, I heard they have like this thing that they do in the recipe that really gets these great results. And so like a lot of the way AI development has proceeded in the past has been very secretive. It's been the realm of like trade secret. And so I think like one of the interesting things here is like, can we create an index that kind of creates sort of like a race to the top, right? Like avoid a world in which everybody's incredibly closed about their model. And you know, I guess I'm curious, you know, Marina, like as a researcher in the space, you know, do you feel like it's working, right? Like this strategy, like, do you think FMTI is like helping to improve or like encourage companies to be more transparent in the space? And if so, I'm kind of curious about like how far you think it will go, because presumably at some point, all companies will be like, well, we can't definitely tell you about that, right? And so I think we're kind of playing with this line about like, what do companies owe to the public when they release these models? And yeah, just kind of curious as someone who's kind of like a researcher in the trenches thinking about this, how you sort of see this type of effort.
Sure. So I'll start again with agreeing with Kate that this at least encourages people because they see, oh, other companies are saying stuff, so it's maybe okay or good for PR or for adoption reasons for me to also say stuff. First, everybody had to get to a certain point of quality. So when nobody could figure out how to get the models to a certain point of quality, no one was going to say anything just in case they came up with the right secret sauce and I'm not going to share. As people, I think, start to get the technology be a little bit more evolved, a little bit more mature, okay, now there are reasons, including economic ones, of why you'd want to share, because that'll be the kind of thing that your clients or customers will, you know, pick you over somebody else because of aspects of this. So this kind of public pressure of, well, they did this, so I'm going to do this, this bit is actually really good. There's going to be a limit to how far it's going to go. Of course, nobody's going to share like customer data or also anything that might get them bad PR or anything that might get them potentially in hot legal waters or anything of the kind.
Sure, right. Yeah.
People won't
yeah.
share. But overall, it's a good trend. It speaks to the evolving maturity of the field to me. So that's how I see sort of that back and forth going.
Yeah, I mean, you can see it in the scores too. Like the scores from October to this latest report in May have gone up across everyone who was evaluated. Like I think there's this like safety in numbers where also given the regulations are still evolving and everyone, you know, a lot of case law is still evolving, people are kind of testing the waters, but as more and more results are shared and people are more and more transparent, it gives confidence for more people to do the same.
It does sort of feel like things like transparency, right? Or like things like, you know, chatbot arena, they're in some ways kind of like of a piece, which is that like early on, everybody was sort of like competing against these like benchmarks. And essentially like as the benchmarks have become like more and more saturated, now it seems like everybody's trying to differentiate in different ways. And like one of the differentiations is like, is your model transparent or not, right? Which is almost like a factor that sits, you know, somewhat on top of the model, but also like outside of it as well.
I was just going to say, if you actually look at the places where the scores are still low, I think right off the top of my head, I know it's about like evaluation of model trustworthiness. How do you do it? And then also downstream applications. These are things that we're not yet very good at, do not understand yet very well. So those are the cards that people are still kind of holding a little closer to their chest in case, again, this turns into a differentiator. So again, it just makes the point of lots of the scores are improved. It's very interesting to see the ones that haven't, because it again gives a sense of, you know, what is the confidence and the maturity of the technology.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll add this in the conference IBM Think this week, I maybe talked to 50 plus customers. Governance, transparency, trust, it was in every single discussion. And over the last year, Granite and the work that we're doing at IBM is really a differentiator. Our customers really appreciate that. And in fact, if you follow me on LinkedIn, I'm extremely open and I publish a few times the research paper from Granite, which I recommend everyone to go check because it explains very well where they went to train the model, and the data collection process, the data pre-processing, we've been extremely open. You won't find a paper with such openness on where they went to train the model. So that is actually becoming more and more important, because companies, they take these models as a base model, and then they mix it up with their own enterprise data. So you need to get a very good base model that you can trust if you are going to mix it up with your own data to get outcomes.
Yeah, Armand, you're anticipating my question, because I think one of the things I think is a point of critique as well. Okay. There's a bunch of academics at Stanford, right? Like, is this actually impacting how business is behaving? It sounds like your answer is yes. Like, actually, it turns out that, like,
companies
are there looking at the FMTI being like, well, this actually is relevant to my purchasing decision, which is really, really pretty interesting.
Well, just to build on your point a little bit, Armand's like, you know, it's not like you're just taking these models and then adding a layer on top. Like, when a model provides a response, you can't pinpoint back that the model is using your data or its pre-training data. You know, it all basically, you know, goes into a blender and comes out mixed together the other end. So just because you're going for applications with your own data and using RAG patterns or even fine-tuning and other things, it doesn't mean that you have control over all of the history you're inheriting and baggage and skeletons and closets you could potentially be inheriting when using some of these models.
Yeah, totally. So, Kate, final question I'm curious if you have any thoughts on is, you know, kind of almost talking about the trend is like, where does things like FMTI go into the future? And I guess I want to kind of relay a fear, and maybe you can allay my fear, but I don't know if you agree, is basically like, you know, I agree. I think one of the nice things about FMTI, though, having been in a company that received an FMTI request, was like, oh, you know, it's basically like they have not taken any shortcuts, right? They're basically like, how do we know whether or not you're transparent? I don't know. It depends on how well you do against these 100 indicators, right? Which is like a massive, it's like a project in order to take on responding to the FMTI. And I guess I'm kind of curious and maybe a little bit worried about kind of the commercial pressures on indices like FMTI. What I mean by that is, you know, if you're a B2B buyer, you're an enterprise, like on the market looking for, you know, a model to use for your internal operations, 100 indicators is like a lot, you know, like there's a reason people go to Wirecutter and they're like, oh, I will buy the same fridge that everybody else has. Or like, I'll buy the same, you know, wire manager that everybody else has. Do you worry at all that like as these indices become more and more used by industry, like by businesses to make purchasing decisions, we'll also see kind of like pressure to kind of like narrow? Like people do ultimately just want like transparent or not, or like, you know, rubber. And so, you know, if you do agree with that, like I'm kind of curious if you have thoughts on like how do we keep that aperture open, right? Because it's important for us to like keep the kind of transparency that it sounds like Percy and team is really chasing after here. So, and a couple of thoughts there, but curious about like how you'd navigate that.
I mean, I think particularly when regulations start to come into act, you know, there's going to be tremendous pressure to be able to put a rubber stamp on something and say it's compliant or not compliant. So there'll certainly be pressure along those lines. But, you know, it's a similar risk that you bring up that you have with also gamification. Like people are going to just start optimizing for a couple of key things, and how do we make sure that we continue to push forward and to drive how we're innovating? And I really think it comes down to making sure that we're continuing to keep pace on how we define transparency and safety in models with how fast this technology is growing. So if you look at how we looked at large language models a year ago and what was considered state of the art and what was considered safe versus not safe a year ago compared to today, it is an entirely different story. And it's going to need to continue to evolve. And we need researchers like those at Stanford helping us articulate too what those risks are, coming up with more nuanced ways as some of these metrics and indices become saturated. Everyone's always, you know, sharing all this information. You know, maybe we can shift our focus into some of these new emerging things that we need to continue to keep in mind.
Yeah, and I think that will be the new game, is like the initial task is like getting the companies to do this. Yeah. And then now that sort of the challenge is like, well, we don't want you to game it. So like the criteria also may also become this kind of game where it's like, well, we won't tell you what the criteria are for certain types of indicators in order to kind of retain the benefit of the signal.
But I think that's to our benefit as a field, right?
Totally.
If we don't have some sort of incentive to keep innovating, then, you know, it's going to become stagnant. So certainly welcome it.
So I'll move us on to our last topic here. And Armand, I'm going to give you center stage because it sounds like you were had a really busy week presenting all of this. This was IBM's Think Week. It continues the season of announcements. Everybody's announcing AI stuff right now. And so I guess, I think just as an open question, Armand, do you want to just kind of quickly give a thumbnail sketch of everything? I know in particular, you were very excited about the announcements around WatsonX. And if you just want to give like a thumbnail sketch to our listeners about what was announced, because I read the blog post and I was like, this is going to be a lot to cover in 15 minutes. But I think you as an expert would probably be able to put us best on track on, you know, what people should be paying attention to.
Yeah, there is so much. I'm going to be a little bit selfish and talk about the area of WatsonX that I cover, which is the AI platform part. I will start with the Granite models that they are now open source, and I'll let Kate elaborate on that. So, but we're really excited to just jump into the open source movement. And then we have something called Instruct Lab that helps customize models. So, I'll let explain. Kate will explain that a lot better. She's been driving a lot of that from the research angle. Then we announced a very exciting partnership with Mistral as well. And we already had Mistral open source models in our platform, and we offer that to our customers. Now we also have the Mistral commercial models that includes Mistral Large and Mistral Small. And that is, we love Mistral, and now we're going to be able to offer that to customers in the cloud and on-prem as well. And specifically in Europe, that's going to be a very big hit. We released a lot of features, so many features. One I would like to highlight is, for example, chat with your documents, the classic RAG use case. We introduce a user interface that is very easy to add documents or point to a vector database. You can have thousands of documents there. And in just a few clicks, you can create your own chat interface to talk to the documents that will pinpoint directly to the reference and to the citations. And then you can export that as an application or as an endpoint that you can integrate with your own application. So there are a lot of tools like that that will make the development of solutions very flexible. The last one I would like to highlight is One is a toolkit that we are releasing in tech preview for application developers to make it extremely easy to develop GenAI applications. So we're all the time talking about LLMs, but LLMs don't make applications and solutions. LLMs are just one component. And coming back to the RAG use case, you need an embeddings model, you need a vector database, you need to chunk the data. So you need a lot of different things. So we believe we're creating one of the best toolkits for developers to make the development of those use cases extremely simple with a lot of templates and access to tools. And the last one on the governance. On the governance, we also release a lot of stuff. I'll highlight what we're doing with AWS. We have a very good partnership with AWS, and SageMaker is a very popular tool for enterprise to just build and deploy machine learning models. And now you can govern all those models directly with watsonx.governance. That means you can have like your full central panel, MLOps panel, and then you have those components of regulatory compliance and risk management to make sure those models perform. So those are just a few, but there are so many new assistants and other features. But maybe let me hand it over to Kate. You can explain the open source angle on Granite and Instruct Lab.
Yeah, before Kate, you jump in, it does feel like it's like open source. Like the big message is you're
that
all in
the
on open source.
Yeah, it was really exciting to be there. You know, it was hosting my hometown this year, which was really fun in Boston. And the message across every single presentation was IBM is all in on open source. And so it was really, really exciting to be there and to be part of the announcement for the Granite code models that we released. So we open sourced 8 state-of-the-art Granite code models, 2 variants for 4 different model sizes, a 3B, an 8B, a 20B, and a 34 billion parameter models. And especially the 8 billion parameter model, really we're seeing state-of-the-art performance and its ability to outperform anything else that has come out there. We're really thrilled just to be able to create this as a starting point that the rest of the community can operate under. And a lot of, Armand's mentioned Instruct Lab, a lot of our intent behind releasing the Instruct Lab open source project, which I think you guys covered in an earlier episode as well, is giving the community, the open source community, the tools to work on models together. So allowing them to collaborate and contribute to models and build ultimately a better model that benefits from the world working together. And, you know, I think it gets, Marina, kind of to your earlier point of like, you know, there's a lot of big personalities who are trying to define how AI works and the world works. And that's one version of the world, but that's not how IBM sees it. And it's really only through, you know, an open source ecosystem where we bring the best that the community has to offer and everyone working together that I think we'll really be able to unlock the future potential here.
So I'll reveal a little bit of my own bias here. Huge open source head, struggled for many years running just like Linux. Like that was my childhood, was like running free and open source software locally. And I think one of the things, you know, I kind of would love the three of you to kind of respond to is essentially like this kind of interesting question that I saw popping up on social media this week, which is how sustainable is open source, right? And, you know, I think one of the debates, I mean, speaking about big personalities that want to define AI, right? So there's a bunch of very loud VCs on AI arguing about this. But I think that the root of the debate, I think, is an interesting one, right? Which is that, you know, you look at the pre-training costs of state-of-the-art models. And as we scale bigger and bigger and bigger, it just gets more and more and more expensive to like accumulate the computing clusters you need to do this, to do the pre-training runs. And I think, you know, I think one of the arguments sort of being made right now, right, is there coming a point where basically like these next generation models are becoming so, so expensive that like it would be very, very difficult to imagine any company that originates these models being willing to open source them going forwards. So that essentially sort of the argument is that there's a point at which kind of like the sort of like upside from open sourcing is going to be outweighed by sort of like the raw pre-training cost of these models. And you know, the conclusion goes, right, with these big personalities on Twitter is basically like, dot, 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 open source has a ceiling. Do you all buy that argument? If not, why not?
I don't buy that argument. I mean, I think there is incentive to continue to drive model performance, spend more and creating bigger and bigger models. Mm-hmm. But I think we're seeing diminishing returns in terms of the use cases and the value. You can accomplish a ton of incredibly, take care of low-hanging fruit, so to speak, with much smaller models that are going to be the ones that you're actually deploying and using day-to-day. Like, that's where I think the economic value is going to drive, and that's where open source is really well-positioned. I also think we're also, you know, we're learning a lot this past year, these past couple of months, in terms of how to unlock value and improve performance in models. And most of the cost is spent on pre-training, right? As you say, you know, burning GPUs for months, thousands of GPUs to create a base model. But then there's a step afterwards called alignment. And that's where the open source community has really been leading the innovation. They take these models like the Llama model series that's incredibly popular, and they take that base model and iterate on the alignment step. And that is far less costly, far less compute intensive. So we're able to drive, you know, these step changes without having to resort back to just burning compute hours for, you know, eons, driving up crazy costs. So I don't think that's a valid argument in my mind.
Yeah, for sure. Armin, Marina, do you want to jump in at all, or do you largely agree?
I fully agree. And then we're all in on open source at IBM, and I see the passion of the community, and that's really, really hard to compete with, right? Like even companies are using the open source pitch that, to attract talent, researchers. They want to see their work contributed back to the community and not closed source and behind an API and their work not represented in any different way than just a commercial API. So I think there is also that angle as well. The power of the community is proving to attract the best minds in the planet to progress on AI.
Yeah, it's fascinating to believe that, you know, like the era of big scale is already over. Like essentially, like the competition has already shifted. Like it has turned out that like scale was not all you needed. Like actually, you needed a lot more than scale in some ways. I think, Kate, what's also really interesting in what you say is I think a little bit also about like, you know, in a company using AI, like in any company, there's this like hierarchy of prestige, right? Who's doing the important work? Who's the rock star? And for a very long time, pre-training was like the rock stars, right? Like, oh man, they're like really using these like, you know, F1 computers to like kind of create these like, you know, beings of pure linear algebra. But like kind of what you're saying is like, actually the future is not that. Like in fact, like it's turned out that like what was traditionally almost low prestige in the machine learning space, which is you just do the fine tuning at the end to make it a nice chatbot, is actually where the action is going to be. Do you buy that? Like in the future, people are going to be like, oh my God, that person's like a god of fine tuning. Like this person's so amazing at alignment. Like they're the ones. And this commodity stuff is like pre-training.
I mean, I think the community like is quickly already there if we're not already. It is insane the amount of innovation that's happening at that part of the process. And there's just so much untapped potential given, relatively speaking, how cost effective it is. So, you know, I think that's where we're also going to continue just to be incentivized, and where rock stars, as you say, will be made, because you're going to do what pre-training had to spend millions and billions of dollars to do, and, you know, a fraction of that.
Yeah. Should I ask the question then? Why keep scaling? Is it an insane thing for the industry to be doing?
Okay, well, the hidden curse of why alignment's doing so well is you need big models to make good small models. Mm. So, you know, there is this paradox here of like, okay, small models are where we're incentivized, but at some point, if you don't have a big model, you can't make a good small model. But we're also seeing a lot of open source, great larger models come out. There's a bit of a play there that has to still, I think, evolve in terms of, you know, the market still needs to feel out how that's going to fully play out. For model providers.
So this is great. Any final thoughts, Armand and Marina?
I think that these things go in waves. So we had a wave of like scale, scale, scale in a way that you just could never do before. And that was amazing. So it's very natural that we say, all right, we've maybe hit not a plateau, but it may be a little bit of a slight slowing down in the S curve. All right, let's see what else we can do. It's going to come back again. And meanwhile, it's a very reasonable thing to continue to try to see, well, what can we meanwhile do with the hardware, with the acceleration, with everything else? Because it's going to come up again for some reason or another. So it's very good and natural that you go from scaling and now it's like, all right, how do you get small from big? It's probably going to go again. Okay, now can we turn those small things into, once again, something big? It's this is a normal and
it's like a pendulum swinging, basically.
It's always pendulums. So we're just in that part of the swing. So it's not that it's not valuable. It's just that what are people innovating the most rapidly? And that the pendulum will swing of where the focus is there.
I will add just things that people don't talk about it that much is, for example, when Llama 3 went out, I think Llama 3 had... what was the context window? Like 32,000 or 16,000, but it wasn't super large. And days after the release, the community was already contributing a version with a technique to increase the context window. So those are small details that only the practitioners notice, and they don't get into the headlines. But that is really the power of open source. That those contributions, that innovation, and that's going to be really, really hard, to stop.
Yeah, that's a great note to end on. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Marina, thanks for coming back on the show.
Pleasure.
And Kay, Armand, it's been awesome having you on the show for the first time, and hope to have you again on the show sometime.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for a great discussion.
Thanks for joining Mixture of Experts. And for the first time, a quick call out to all you listeners. We're thinking about doing a segment in the next few weeks that will focus specifically on agents and what's happening there. We're always looking for interesting stories and people to talk to. So if you've seen any cool papers or companies or people working in the space, please drop a line in the comments on it, and we'd love to pick it up in a future episode. See you next time.